Greetings and welcome to episode 5 of Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am one of your hosts, Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav.
And I am the other one, Ben Chandler, also known as Ben 304. Hello, Grundislav, how are you?
Hello, Ben. I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. I have a little confession to make, actually. I forgot to mention this, and I thought, I can come out with it now.
Oh, really? Well, what is it?
I got some new games this week, Grundislav. Well, not new games, but I found some games on sale, so I picked up some more games.
Really? What games did you pick up? And how many?
Well, I got 20.
Oh, my!
So I won't name them all.
Man, Ben Chandler, you really go hardcore when you buy games.
You know I like buying games. My collection is now up to 487, the physical ones. I don't know how many digital ones I've got, but yeah. My goal is to get 500 for the year, so I've got lots of game playing to do. But anyway, let's talk about the podcast.
Yeah, let's talk about the podcast. So we've got a few things to talk about today. We've got reviews, as always.
Yeah, we have.
We've got a new segment that we're going to put in at the end, which our listeners will probably enjoy. And we're going to talk about writing.
Yeah, and a continuity of our radio play and deliverance and all sorts of things. But yeah, writing, it's kind of a topical thing for us at the moment because we're both sort of getting to the end of our current projects and we're starting to look at designing something new. So it's something we're thinking about.
That's right. That's right. Your project, of course, is Piss for Summer Batch, and
absolutely,
yes.
And you're working on the 8th Ben Jordan.
I am,
which is highly anticipated.
Maybe by like my mother or something, but yes. So basically means that we are moving on to other things. Would you care to tell us? Maybe give us a teaser of what's coming next from Ben Chandler.
Well, I've actually got a couple of things that I'm looking at doing. One of them is very innovative, I'll say. As far as I know, nobody's ever done this before, ever. Ooh. But I could be wrong. And the other one, I'd like to do something a little more serious, a little more science fiction, a little more underwater. So, yeah, a little bit of aquapunk. And what are you looking at doing, Grundislav?
Well, I've actually already started designing and writing out and doing some graphics for my game, which is quite a departure from the whole paranormal mystery series. My intent is to make it a full standalone single game, and it's going to be, I think it might also have something to do with things that haven't been done before as far as a story perspective. Well, maybe not quite as innovative as yours, but I think we'll just say the profession of my main character is a profession that hasn't really been explored in games before. So I'll leave that to your...
It's always good to try new stuff.
Yeah, I'll leave that to your imagination and rampant speculation. So so writing and design.
That really is something. In fact, it can be something that's really just comes to you in just, in the flash of inspiration that sometimes happens. You can sometimes get a whole game, and sometimes I know I can spend weeks puzzling over a single section of game.
Oh, absolutely. Do you know where I usually get my best ideas, Ben Chandler?
Is it the bathroom, Grundislav?
Why, yes, it is. And I've heard other people say it also is the place where they
Vince,
get their ideas.
Vince 12 has said the same thing. I have the same problem. Albert Einstein was quoted as saying, "Why do I always get my best ideas in the shower?"
Oh, man, I get my best ideas in the shower all the time. It's like some sort of channel for great, brilliant ideas.
I think it's because you're not encumbered by clothing. We should all go around naked.
Nude game design. If that were the case, why don't nudist colonies like become game developers?
Good point. Well, maybe. Well, see, we're talking about ideas on a general scale now. We've involved Einstein. I don't think he ever made a game. Oh, I could be wrong. I'm not sure. I haven't really looked into his ludography. But anyway, I remember I was dating a girl at one point, and I said to her at one point, why do I always get good ideas in the shower? And she was quite a bit of a scientist, and I don't know whether this is just nonsense that she made up on the spot, but she claimed that the water vapor in the air, like the stopped dust particles from getting up her nose and blocking your thoughts, and I thought, that's not right, but who knows?
That sounds like the sort of thing people who wear tinfoil hats would say.
Well, tinfoil hats are pretty stylish and cool.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Anyway, so that's apart from showering, what do you do when you write Grundlisluf?
I want to make the point that I do shower regularly when I'm writing. It's not like I go into some sort of no showering funk when I get writer's block. Although that probably would be appropriate.
I would hope so.
The smellier I am, the worse I am at ideas.
Maybe writer's block related to block pores.
Maybe it is. But, anyway. Well, I don't know. Usually I get my ideas in the shower, or not always, but I sometimes get ideas in the shower. Or if I'm having a particularly difficult time developing an idea, I'll take a nice long shower and I'll think about it. And sometimes something will come to me and sometimes it won't. But usually I just sit and think. I like to also sometimes mix up my environment, go outside, you know, go to a coffee shop or something, like very, very little, because I used to work at a coffee shop. So that's not really an environment that's really conducive to creativity for me. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, basically, I don't know. I just kind of sit and hope that things will come to me, and sometimes they do. Now, what do you do, Ben Channel?
Me? Well, I'm like, I go for a walk. I often put my headphones on, and if it's a nice day, I'll step outside and I'll walk. You know, sometimes I'll just walk a kilometer, and that's enough. Sometimes I can walk, you know, 10 kilometers and get home and still haven't had my thought. Sometimes, you know, I'll be at work and I'll just be doing my job. My job's quite menial and labor intensive, but not very brain intensive, so I don't have to think much about what I'm doing, so I can often sort of get lost in a bit of a daydream while I'm going about my job and just think about what's going on. And sometimes, you know, I'll be at work and I'll think of something and go, oh wow, that's the exact thing that I've been stuck on. I find in the shower that I often come through breakthroughs. If I've gotten to the point, you know, I'm home from work and I've eaten and I'm working on a game and I just can't get past the thing, I go, well, I'll go and have my shower now and hopefully I'll come up with something then. But usually it's going for a walk. Every now and then, if things get really bad, I actually lie on the floor and stare at the ceiling, which probably sounds a bit strange, but it works, you know. And other times, I look at inspirational material. You know, if I'm doing a science fiction game, I might play a different science fiction game and go, well, what have they done? You know, see what works, see what doesn't work. If I can play a science fiction game and go, this just doesn't work, I go, well, I'll try and do something completely opposite to that. What can I change that's the norm in science fiction? I also write down a lot. I have notebooks, like just pages and pages and pages of crap scribbled down and crossed out, and yeah, writing things down helps me to think about things. Also, talking to people about it. If you've got an idea, and I find this, if you've got sort of the rough basis of an idea and you discuss it with someone, even if they don't answer back to you, as you say it, you kind of realize what sounds good and what sounds really dumb. So you go, oh man, I realize how contrived this all feels. So talking to someone about it, if you've got... Yeah.
I've told people about the idea for my game that I'm working on, and I've had to kind of reshape a few things, because when I've said certain things, I'm just like, wow, this sounded a lot better when I wrote it down and in my head, but just saying it sounds kind of bad.
Yeah, it does feel silly when you have to sort of back up what you're telling someone to keep them interested and go, you know, how am I going to really sell this to him? You suddenly realize, oh man, that's a really dumb idea. I need to make it less contrived and more natural sometimes.
I think another thing that helps too is listening to music. If I want to get like a certain mood that I want to be in or that I feel is necessary to write the game, I'll listen to a lot of related music. Like I can tell you, for when I was doing Ben Jordan, the second one, which I wanted to be more like a spaghetti western, I listened to so much Ennio Morricone music and spaghetti western music. And I remember when I was making Ben Jordan Case 3, since it was set in like the Scottish Highlands and they had the witches and stuff, the third Harry Potter movie had just come out recently, earlier that summer, and I had the soundtrack. So I was listening to all like the instrumental, like Harry Potter music. That one I thought had a really nice soundtrack, so I bought it. So I listened to that a lot for Case 3. And for Case 8, I made a playlist, which I very pretentiously called To Inspire Melancholy, and it had a lot of like Radiohead and like a bunch of sad music that I thought would fit like the whole rainy environment of Case 8. And so yeah, I listened to that a lot while I was writing the game, and that helped a bit.
I do find music probably inspires me more than games, to be honest. If you look at, some of my games, even some of the names are taken from song titles and album titles and things like that. So music for me is a huge one. But I mean, anyone who's played the first Airwave game can probably tell that I'm a big fan of music. And also for me, a lot of the time, the weirdest people you meet is if I'm out with the band and playing a gig, I'll meet really crazy stuff happens when you're out playing gigs. So usually if I see something like that, I usually try and find a way to shoehorn it into a game.
Any examples that you care to mention?
I couldn't tell you one offhand, but I can tell you the craziest thing I've ever seen is after the last New Year's gig we played, I got up at 5 a.m. to go and get our car with all the trailer full of junk, so I'm walking out from the hotel and I walk down the street and there's a guy listening to classical music really loudly. This is at 5 a.m. while kicking a beer can down the street. And I'm like, "Oh, what are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, hey man, party's still going." I'm like, "Oh my God. This is a really weird town. We need to get out of here before we get eaten." But yeah, a lot of stuff, when it's a gig, people come up to you who wouldn't normally come up to you and talk to you, and you get to meet some strange sorts. So usually I take inspiration from that. But yeah, even just talking to people, there have been lines in game. I remember when I made Featherweight, I was at work one day and someone said something. I think the line was something like, "I dreamt that we lost another one last night." And I was like, "Wow, that's a really chilling thing to say to someone."
That
So
is.
I worked that into the game. I think that might be the first line of the game. It's been a long time since I've played it, but I'm pretty sure that's the first line of the game. It really inspired me to take the story somewhere where I wasn't previously going to take it.
Now, one question that I've heard a lot, and I've been asked myself, and just seems to be the favorite question for interviewers interviewing people about who make adventure games is, how do you come up with your puzzles? And boy, howdy, what a
Grunderslav.
question that is.
Grunderslav,
Yes,
how do you
304.
come up with your puzzles? Please tell us. By us, I mean myself and the listeners. I'm interested. We're all curious.
Well, I have this machine, you see, which I built called the Puzzle-O-Matic 300, and it's like a slot machine. And when you pull the lever, a verb will come up, and then a noun, and then an inventory item. So it will be like, well, actually, it's the other way around. Verb, inventory item, and then noun. So I'll pull it, and it'll be like,
Man.
chase bird, tree. And I'll think, why, that's brilliant. We'll have a puzzle where you have to chase a bird into a tree.
Are
No,
you
that's
still
what.
using version 300? I used the 304 one. I
Oh,
can't believe you've not upgraded.
is that the one that has actual articles in it? Like, chase the bird
Yeah.
into the tree? Okay.
Yeah, conjunction.
I see. No, actually, the way I come up with puzzles is it really depends on the game and the story. Usually I'll write the story out first, and as I'm writing the plot, the obstacles in the plot just kind of appear. And so when you have your obstacles laid out, that's when you kind of sit down and think, okay, well, how can I get around these? And it really depends on the tone you're going for. I mean, if you're going for the wacky LucasArts, as I've already said, mayonnaise on like the floor to lubricate things,
It was
you can do
chicken
that.
fat. It was chicken grease. It wasn't mayonnaise.
Well, there was mayonnaise in Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis.
Oh, I never played that.
Oh, yeah, there's a puzzle where you have to use mayonnaise to lubricate the bottom of a totem pole so you can slide it across the floor and climb up it. Which, I have to say, for Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, which was a relatively
Yeah,
serious
that's
game,
unexpected.
yeah, it was kind of an out there puzzle. But to its credit, it was not necessarily a puzzle that you would have to encounter because it was one of the several paths that you may or may not have to
Sure.
take. So you could go through the game and never have to see that puzzle. So usually it's just a product of circumstance, I guess. You have to get away from the mindset of this is an adventure game, you have to have obstacles just for the sake of having obstacles, you know.
And
If
that's a
you have
hard mindset to get out of, especially
oh
as a new designer.
it absolutely is. As a new designer, you're gonna want to, like, you know, all your puzzles are going to be, oh, there's a locked door. Let's unlock the door. That's the easiest puzzle. When you boil it down to it, all adventure game puzzles are use key on door. In fact, I think Yahtzee, Ben Croshaw, wrote a series of articles on adventure gamers called Use Key on Door, because whether it's a door that you have to actually use a physical key, or if it's a character that you need to distract somehow, or it's just some magic chest that needs an amulet to open or something like that, it all basically boils down to you need to get this item and use it to progress like this. Or, you know...
Sure, it's
need...
obstacle-based gameplay.
Exactly. So the challenge lies in coming up with creative obstacles that make the player think that they're not actually using the key on the door. They think that they're doing something different when in reality they're just using the key on the door. But shh, don't tell anybody. So...
I think the biggest thing for me is when I'm designing a puzzle is first design your world and design your character. And from there, you can figure out what will work. You know, if you've got a character and story, you can kind of think about how they will interact with the environment. I know Tim Schafer was talking about the difference between Ben Throttle and...
Bernard. That's my favorite example.
Yeah, Bernard. Yeah, exactly, with the sandwich and how Bernard takes the toothpick out of the sandwich and picks the door, the lock, and Ben eats the sandwich and kicks the door down. I think that's a really good example of how your world and your character is going to affect the way that you should design your puzzle. Because if you put a puzzle that feels out of place in there, people are going to notice and it's going to break the immersion for them.
Exactly. If you have a big tough guy as your main character, you're not going to have him doing complex computer science resonance style puzzles. You're just gonna have him shoot the lock or kick the door down or something like that. But yeah.
Which is fun. I mean, if you look at Gemini Rue compared to Resonance and you look at the puzzles just there, you go from, you know, a detective in one sense, the science fiction detective, to the other sense with the, you know, the investigative journalist. You can see the huge difference in style there. It's big. You know, there's no shooting or anything like that when you can hack emails and things like that. So, yeah, I think a big part of puzzle design, let it flow naturally. I've done this before. I've created an area and then sort of gone, well, now how can I design obstacles in this area and actually let the puzzles come from the game world itself rather than going, this is a puzzle I will use. Some of my favorite puzzles have come from that. Creating a character, creating an area, and then going, how can I make this gameplay?
Yeah. One of a puzzle that I came up with a long time ago that I was actually pretty proud of for a game that I never released, which I ended up recycling for Ben Jordan 5, was there's a bit where you have to get someone's signature on a form and they won't give it to you. So the usual adventure game cliche, I guess, would be to drug the person and hypnotize them, get them to give you the signature. You start thinking of outlandish, wacky ways to get a signature. But then you have to think, okay, well, let's ground this a little bit maybe more in reality. And the solution to the puzzle ended up being you have to find a note or something or some other document that's been signed by the person whose signature you need. And then you just use the document you need signed on the signature and you forge the person's signature. Now, how deep you want to go into that depends on your game. The way I did it was just, you know, a simple use item on item thing. But if you really wanted to get detailed and you really maybe wanted to go for a little bit more diverse gameplay, you could always have it so that, like, you had to find some sort of light source or something that you have to put the other document on, and then you could have like a close-up of the signature and then have to like trace over it with your mouse just for the immersion style thing. There's lots of ways you could go with that to make things different. You know, it all depends on how simple or how complex you want to go.
I think you can get lost with the gimmick there, where sometimes you have a puzzle, and I find this happens to me, you have a puzzle and you know what you have to do, but the way to do it is complex and too complex, and you go, this is more difficult than it should be. It ruins the game for me.
Oh yeah. But there's plenty of ways, an easy trap also to fall into, which is why beta testing your game and having other people play it is so important, is you come up with a puzzle and you have a very specific solution to it, and you get so involved in how specific your solution is that you forget about other things you might have in your game already. And, you know, you don't think, well, wouldn't it just be easier to do this? Whereas, you know, your beta testers might say, like, you could have a really complex puzzle where you have to use, I don't know, you have to make an axe or something to chop down a door, but you have a lockpick that you've forgotten about or something, and your playtesters will say, well, why can't you just use the lockpick on the door? I keep using locked doors as an example here. This is terrible. But
we're talking about adventure games. I think that is a very common trap. I know I've fallen into the trap myself and afterwards gone, man, why didn't any of my testers point that out? That's a really stupid thing for me to have done. But when you're focused on a game, it's sometimes hard to see the big picture.
Oh, yeah.
Do you enjoy designing in non-linear style? I know you've had multiple endings done before. I mean, especially with stuff like Backdoor Man, where it was incredibly non-linear. You could take multiple paths. Do you enjoy designing around this when you write a game?
I do, but if you notice, Backdoor Man didn't really have that many puzzles as such. It didn't. It was just an interactive story for the most part.
I think the only puzzly bit was perhaps finding the medicine for the old lady.
Yeah, but even that had several different ways to go about doing it. But yeah.
Yeah, it did. And
as far as non-linearity, I enjoy the idea of having different endings, and I like basically being able to work on different sets of puzzles at different times, like the whole standard three trials system from Monkey Island, where you have these three separate goals, but you can complete them really in any order you want, and if you get stuck on one, you can move on to the other one, which is more difficult to do, but it's, I think, more rewarding to the player in the end, because you have more of an option, and once you get stuck, you're not completely stuck.
Yeah, that's true. I think I know, especially my current game, I've made it, especially the first half, I've made it quite non-linear. You can go about things whichever way you want, you know, and it's been a lot harder to design, but everyone who's played it has gone, oh wow, this is a lot more immersive. So
yeah,
I think there's definitely people are getting used to the non-linear style of play, you know. Games are becoming less and less linear. Even the games that are linear give you multiple paths of doing things. So people like having choice and freedom and things like that. And like you said, with the three trials system, maybe you've got a hint and you want to solve that right now rather than come back to it later. It's good to be able to do that stuff right now and then deal with the other things.
Yeah. Right now I've more or less written out the first chapter for my new game. And the way I've done it is I've kind of got the first half is kind of a more or less tutorial. And so there's a three section sort of non-linear puzzle, which all relates to the same puzzle, but you can kind of complete it in any order you want. And then after that, we get into the whole three trial structure where there's three separate goals that you have to get into. And I've sort of been extending the complexity of the puzzles to meet each goal little by little as I've been writing. But I like to usually keep it so that one of them is a lot easier than the other two, and one of them is really the most complex. I like to have one that's really easy, one that's medium difficulty, and one that's really difficult, just to mix things up a little bit. I don't know if that's necessarily
that's a nice idea.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily a good design choice, but it's something.
I think it's nice to have rewards so you can feel like you've achieved something straight away with an easy puzzle or something like that. But I think it's also nice. People like being challenged. I know the other day I was playing a game. I was playing Edna and Harvey, which I'll review as soon as I finished, as soon as I solved the puzzles. And it had this crazy puzzle in it. And I figured out how to solve the puzzle, but I just couldn't figure out what I needed, the exact thing I needed to do, the element that I needed to solve this puzzle. And a very clever puzzle. And while I was at work the next day, I actually figured out what it was that I had to do. And I rushed home, excited to try this solution. And when it worked, when you solve a difficult puzzle, as long as it's really well hinted at, that's a really rewarding thing. So I think if you can write that into your game, as long as it's done well, it's not a bad thing to have hard puzzles.
No, but also, yeah, people, I know that Tales of Monkey Island in the third episode, there were like maybe, or Maybe from the third episode on, I know that there were several puzzles that involved Guybrush's hook and using that to pick locks on treasure chests and things like that. And people were complaining because they were saying that it was just an obvious solution. It's like anytime you found a locked thing, you automatically knew that you had to use the hook to pick the lock. And yeah, it's rewarding to be able to not have to go through these crazy things to unlock things. But at the same time, it's to have it so simple, it's a bit also sort of a, I don't know, just kind of disappointing. And to have so many of that puzzle also.
Yeah, I think repeated puzzles get a little bit trite. It'd be, yeah. Nobody would want to insult sword fight 20 different times. You know, and learn 20 new sets of insults that just get old blatantly. When it comes to genre, you've stuck to really a set style for so long. Are you interested in trying a new genre, and do you find that that presents new challenges to you?
Yes, actually. I've kind of limited myself to the whole paranormal detective thing because of an 8-series game. or rather, 8-game series. My new game is a bit more grounded in reality. There's no paranormal aspect to it at all. It's actually historical, not to give too much away. So I'm trying to keep the puzzles a little bit more grounded in logic. And it's been an interesting challenge to try and shy away from the whole typical, like, you know, investigate and things like that. Although I've found that I'm going to have to incorporate that, because really a lot of adventure games have to do with investigating, whether you're a detective or not. You kind of become a detective no matter what you do in an adventure game, unless you're trying to escape from a room or something.
Or Monkey Island.
Yes. But I'm definitely looking forward to that. I've also wanted to, I have several ideas for what I want to do. I have an idea for a really more dark and sinister type thing afterwards, which I have not developed at all beyond an initial idea. But I also want to try doing that, something a little bit more, as far as tone goes, not so bright and cheery as... although Ben Jordan's not really bright and cheery, but it's not...
Ben Jordan's not... But I know what you're saying. It's Ben and his mates going around solving ghost mysteries. It's Scooby-Doo, but a bit more serious.
Yeah,
no, it's
exactly.
Not Scooby-Doo. I'm sorry. That's a horrible comparison. But no, I...
Well, see, it starts off as Scooby-Doo, and it ends up being more...
Gabriel Nutt.
Maybe. I don't want to go that far. Okay. But yeah.
I've tried a lot of different genres. You know, every time I'd make a game, I usually like to try a new style, but I've usually kept the tone reasonably lighthearted. At the moment, the game I'm working on, you've played it, it's slightly more serious in tone. I've tried to go with a more grown-up take than I usually do. And,
it's definitely, I have to say, it's definitely the most adult of your games that I've played.
It definitely, well, it has swearing and breasts in it. And,
yeah, oh. I'm not just talking about that one scene, but...
Okay. Yeah, but I think it's fun to experiment with new things. And for me, it's been a real challenge not putting as many stupid jokes in. I love putting stupid jokes into my game, and there's still quite a few, but I try and keep it generally serious. And the next game I'm looking at, well, the next big game I'm looking at doing, I want to do serious as well. So it's really been a big change for me going from, you know, not really, I've had quite a scattered style. I put whatever in amuses me at the time to now really trying to focus on establishing atmosphere and establishing a really coherent world. That's a really big change for me. So I think trying new genres is good to find what works and what, you know, you can get stuck in a rut of doing, oh, I'm going to do 19 Monkey Island games. And I think as you're finding now, it's rewarding to try something new when you're writing.
Absolutely. I mean, I've enjoyed making the Ben Jordan games, but if I could go back and do it all over again, I think I would probably decrease the number of games by about two and just try and tell the whole story a lot more concisely, because it's been 10, or actually it's been 8 years, and yeah, it's definitely, I've been feeling the need to move on to something else for a while now, so.
Yeah, I can understand that. I also find I get bored of settings. People ask me about sequels, and I go, I want to try something. Yeah, and I know each Ben Jordan game is set in a different area, but even new main characters I like doing.
Yeah.
So I think pushing yourself as a writer is, kind of important. I mean, there's a lot of writers who have done very well out of sticking to their series, but I think for me, it's most rewarding to try something new and to learn. It's all about learning for me,
Yeah.
See what works, see what doesn't.
Well, the Ben Jordan games was a good exercise in character development because I tried to,
Absolutely.
keep Ben sort of. The Ben in case one is hopefully different from the Ben in case eight. So
I really think even your
there's
writing
a.
style has improved. If you look at as you know, if you look at in case three when he finds romance and then 10 seconds later has it taken from him. I think you've
Yeah.
allowed yourself more space, more freedom. And this is something I do. I really have this problem is I'll have a relationship that I want to develop and I develop it in the first 5 minutes of the game without letting people get to know the character.
Yeah.
That's something I'm really bad at. Something else I used to do, and this was a really big problem, I'm still trying to get over it, is I would at first, I had this thing where I would just make these sort of faceless characters where they didn't really have a personality because I'd grown up playing stuff like Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale and Fallout, where you play an avatar where you can sort of take multiple choices and they never really have a personality. Whereas adventure games, I think they're really well supported if they've got a main character that's got quite a strong personality. So then what I would do is I would get a main character quirk of this person and shoehorn it into every single line. So I went from the one thing where I didn't give them any personality at all to the other thing where I just totally overloaded and made it totally unrealistic. So I'm really trying to find balance there. This is a really big challenge for me as a writer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about growing. So, yeah.
That's what she said.
Oh.
Strip off your breeches and grease up the pig! It's time for deliverance! Well, butter up my biscuits, Cletus! You know what I hate?
Tell me, Bubba!
I hate it when I'm playing a game and there's a lot of enemies in a place and I go and I kill all them enemies and then I come back because I forgot something and go! Darn, all them enemies are there again, and I gotta kill them again. And I don't have all my health necessarily, and it's just terrible.
I don't understand it, Bubba. I tell you what, they coming back quicker than you can suck down Granny's pig bristle cigarettes. It's like they're having some kind of hoop nanny in there. Or if they was having a hoop nanny, they'd be all line dancing, and you and I'd be at the back with your sister. Yee-haw!
Woo-wee! Let's review some f***ing games! My review this week is a game that came out a couple of months ago, but it's episodic, so it still isn't completely out. I'm, of course, talking about The Walking Dead. Now, episode 2 came out yesterday, June 29th, as of this recording, that was yesterday. I have not played it yet, and I'm not planning on playing it until I finish my own game, because I have set a very strict no more gaming embargo until I finish with my game, so I'm kind of wondering what my review next week will be, but that's neither here nor there. The Walking Dead is Telltale Games' adaptation of the comic series, as well as the television. Well, the television series was an adaptation of the comic series, but it's, as you probably know and can infer from the title, about zombies. And a lot of people were wondering how Telltale was going to handle it, because Telltale has this sort of reputation for being like a family-friendly developer, and most of their stuff is based on licenses, but sort of general audiences, family-friendly licenses. So The Walking Dead
I just have to say, it's kind of rough saying that Sam and Max is family-friendly when you look at some of the jokes in there, but anyway, do go on.
Well, true, but Sam and Max at most would earn a T rating if they had ratings. The Walking Dead is a very heavy, very hard M by far. I mean, there's swearing, there's F-bombs all over the place, there's extreme gore. I mean, you're killing zombies with, like, axes and ice picks and blood and stuff, and I read a few, because I'm a spoiler kind of guy, and I like to ruin things for myself, and I read some reviews on the forums about episode 2, and from what I've gathered, it is extremely violent, like,
oh wow,
very, very violent, so I'll be able to tell you more, I'm sure, after I've played it eventually, but yeah. So, it's an interesting choice that Telltale has gone with as far as growing as a developer, kind of showing that they can do more adult-oriented things. Now, when I played the first episode, I hadn't read the comic. I had watched the first episode, the first season of the TV series, and I have to say I don't really like the TV series all that much as the comics. I've since then ordered and been reading the compendium of Volume 1. And it's an interesting comic book. But the game itself is, you know, your traditional Telltale game. It's not really it is point and click. You move your character with the arrow keys and you kind of use your mouse to click on hotspots and things like that. But it's kind of a departure from Telltale's usual style in that the puzzles are a lot more, I guess, organic in the sense that there's really not much call during the zombie apocalypse to use, like, you know, mayonnaise to lubricate a floor to push something along. It's a lot more, you know, just like pick up axe, try and find a way around the zombies sort of thing, which I liked. I liked that the puzzles really basically just involved staying alive and kind of just sneaking your way around. It's like stealth adventuring, I guess, because the whole point is you can't make too much noise or else the zombies will come and get you. So you have to think of creative ways. Yeah, the puzzles lie in the ways to creatively take out, you know, a group of zombies. So another thing that's being billed as one of the more revolutionary things that Telltale is doing as well is the whole factor of choice and how your choices affect the story and how they affect the rest of the episodes. In the first game, there's about 5 major choices that at the end of the episode it tells you what you did and compared to all the other players, how many people made the same choice as you. And there's actually two characters who you have to choose between them whether they live or die. So one will be dead in the next episode. So that's interesting. It'll be interesting to see once the whole series. Yeah, I've heard the developers in interviews say that basically every single thing that you can do in the game has an effect on the future story possibilities. So it'll be interesting to see how far it branches and how much they allow for it, because theoretically that should mean that, like, episode 5 might be a completely different gaming experience for 2 different people based on the choices they've made in the previous 4 episodes. I have my doubts personally, because there's only so far you can go, I think, and in games that we've seen, like Heavy Rain and stuff, where, you know, they say, oh, every action has a consequence, or even Fable or stuff like that. There's really not that much variety. So we'll see. Aside from, like, you know, a character being alive or not, I guess it can open up a whole new avenue of possibilities.
There might be different story outcomes, like in Fallout, I think, but I'd be surprised if the extent of it was further reaching than that.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if there was, like, you know, an entire section of the game that you couldn't play if, like, a character wasn't alive or something like that. That would be a big thing to do. I mean, maybe it has to account, maybe that's why it took so long for the second episode to come out, because they were supposedly going to be released every month, and this one got released 2 months behind, or 1 month behind schedule. So, we'll see. But for now, be interesting to see where it goes.
It makes you wonder if they keep adding to if they keep adding to possibilities like they seem to claim, it's going to get exponentially longer and bigger to make each game. So And do you prefer the control screen? Now, it seems to me like with the Jurassic Park game they did and this one that they're almost following in the footsteps of Quantic Dream for a bit to see how it works. I mean, they've done the LucasArts style comedy adventures for a while, and they did pretty well with them. I thought some of their stuff, I really like some of the stuff they did, Sam and Max and Stromberg and Monkey Island, they did pretty well with that. So do you think they're trying to follow Quantic Dream for a bit to see how it works out for them?
Maybe. I mean, I didn't play Jurassic Park, but from what I heard, it was basically all QuickTime events. And The Walking Dead has some QuickTime events, but I think they make sense in context. They only come up when you're getting attacked by a zombie, really. And it's really just like, mash the button and then kick them away. So it makes sense within context. It's not like, oh, I've picked up a hammer and now I have to press Q, L, C at the same time in order to use it. Like you pick it up and you click it on the zombie and you hit them with the hammer. It feels right.
Fair enough. Do you prefer this control scheme or the point and click scheme? I suppose this might fit a bit better for this genre of game.
I think for this genre of game it does fit better, and I think point and click works better, like for Sam and Max and Monkey Island. Although the last season of Sam and Max, they were using the click and drag or arrow keys. They've kind of shied away from the point and click, which is fine. I mean, I don't mind using the arrow keys to walk around and the mouse to actually click on things. It works. I've gotten used to it, I guess.
I'm going to review Brutal Legend. Now, Brutal Legends, it's a few years old. I think it was released 2009, but I only just got to playing it recently. I was initially put off because it was billed as a real-time strategy game. I have to say, I didn't really think it was much of a real-time strategy game. There are real-time strategy elements in it, but I mean, a lot of the game is action, and there's some role-playing elements in there, sort of. It's quite a mixed bag, you drive around, you've got fighting. The real-time strategy elements are much lighter than they are in something like StarCraft or Warcraft. So, it's by Tim Schafer and Double Fine Studios. He's done the heavy metal sort of setting in Full Throttle, but here it's really taken that much step further. The whole world is this kind of pastiche of all these heavy metal imagery. It's quite clever how they did it. I was impressed the whole time. You drive around, you feel like you're in a 1980s Iron Maiden album cover, which was quite fun, and it's all hot rods and demons and everything like that. One thing that really impressed me was some of the talent that he got to work on this game. Not only did he get Jack Black to be the main character, but he also got the likes of Lemmy Kilminster, Ozzy Osbourne, and Rob Halford, which, in terms of heavy metal, these are huge, huge names. He's got the absolute top of the celebrities there. So it's pretty cool to see how thoroughly they put all this stuff into the game. It's not just, oh, we're making a heavy metal game. They really, really work that into the core of the game. The gameplay can be a little repetitive. It doesn't suffer as much as something like Deathspank, which I found really, really repetitive. But sometimes I found that real-time strategy battles are a little lacking. I actually thought it could have been done as an open-world action game without too much change to the formula, and it would have worked pretty well. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I guess being a heavy metal fan as a teenager, I got quite a few of the little in-jokes and references that were hidden throughout the game, and the soundtrack sort of appealed to me, being a heavy metal soundtrack. And even though I got a little, the gameplay was a little, at times, a little, I guess, underdeveloped with regards to, you do the same thing over and over sometimes, I still thought it worked pretty well. The story was fun. The characters were kind of predictable, but also quite fun. And it told the story that it wanted to tell pretty well. So, yeah, if you were put off like I was by thinking it would be a weird real-time strategy game, don't be, because it's not really. There's a lot of other elements to it. And yeah, it's quite good fun. I'll say check it out.
See, I had the opposite experience. I didn't know that it was going to have real-time strategy elements in it. I thought it was billed as like an action game in the vein of like Psychonauts or something. But when I got it, and I read reviews initially after I had bought it, and it was like, oh, it's actually a real-time strategy game. I thought, oh. And not being a big heavy metal fan, I didn't get any of the in-jokes, but I still enjoyed it because it is from Tim Schafer and Double Fine, so of course the writing is going to be, up to speed with their normal things. I don't consider it one of my favorite Double Fine games by a long
No,
shot,
I
but It's still an enjoyable game.
I think probably if you weren't really into it, it's quite a niche setting there for you. You know, if you're not into heavy metal, so many of the jokes are going to be lost on you. But I have to say, it was a weird choice to try and do a real-time strategy game like this. You know, after Schafer's strong point is writing, and real-time strategy games aren't really known for their writing. But I think it probably, as I said, it worked a lot better than when Ron Gilbert tried to do an RPG. So
yeah.
For me, anyway.
Yeah.
You haven't played Death Bank, have you?
I have not played Death Bank, no.
I don't want to sound facetious or anything like that, but not exaggerating at all, trying to finish Death Bank, well, I finished it, but in the process of doing so, I was literally sitting in my chair playing like with the controller, and my eyes were drooping asleep. That's how bland I found the final parts of the game. Just pure repetitive grinding. So yeah, this was a lot more varied than that, and a lot more story developed, so that was nice.
I was a bit put off by the fact that there was no jump button, though.
Yeah, but there's no jump button in Zelda. So I suppose if you're used to playing Zelda, then you get used to that. If you're not, it's probably very off-putting, but
no.
I didn't find that off-putting. Man, you get Hot Rod and guitar solos. What more? Jump button we can do without. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's time for the next thrilling episode of Spaceman in Space.
I am the spaceman. I am in space. Last time there was something coming over the space horizon. Here I am again. Oh, look at that. It's a space bus. Maybe it's got thermal underwear. I will hail it down. Excuse me, space bus. Oh, I have been run over by the space bus. I am dead. I feel as though my only options now are three. Restore, restart, or quit. I suppose I should restore. Oh, where am I? Oh, I'm back on my spaceship. I remember this. I thought it would be dangerous, so I decided to save my game. Good thing I did, or else I would have had to start from the very beginning. Maybe I should save my game again when I go outside. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. For now, I think I will use my inventory item to open this door. Yes, it has worked. The door is opening. I haven't been in this part of the ship before. To be continued.
Oh yeah. Turn down the lights and open your mind. It's time to ask Bo anything with Bo Nerp.
Hey there, baby. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, who's this? I'll tell you. My name's Bo. I'm a pianist, baby. You know what that means? It means I play the keys. I know you're looking at me. You got a question. You can tell Bo what your question is. Oh, you have trouble importing sprites? I tell you right now, I tell you what you gotta do. You gotta get yourself ready, because it's not gonna work unless you're ready. You open up that OEGS. Open it right up. That's right. Yeah. And then you gotta press the button. You gotta press it real good. That's right. Then you find your sprite, and you put it right inside AGS. And sometimes, you gotta do it more than once. Sometimes, twice. 3 times, 5 times, 10 times, 20 times, I don't care, baby. But you keep going until you got them sprites in. There you go. Now you know. You know. You can tell Bo, and he tell you the answers.
So that does it for this week's podcast. We talked about a lot of things, and we still have more to talk about. Do you think we should continue this on another session?
I think we could probably tackle writing again after we've gone and looked at some other things. There's still a lot I think we could cover there.
That's true. If there's anything specific that you'd like us to talk about with regards to writing, why don't you let us know? Where you can follow us on Twitter. I am at Grundislav Games.
And I am at Ben_304. And if you'd like to make any complaints, specifically with regards to any new segments that were added this episode, please feel free to do so. You can do so there or on the AGS forums.
Yeah, that's right. You can tell Bo all about your complaints that you've had with him.
Until next time, Grundislav, I say farewell.
And I say farewell as well.